Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself and reflect on these conversations.
Well, Anita, it is so nice to have you on the podcast. I feel like we have been planning this what feels like years.
That's probably the truth, right? Yeah. Back and forth for quite a long time. So I'm really glad to actually finally sit and talk to you.
It's funny because I feel like I know you because we chat on Instagram and, you know, we've been emailing as well. But for the listeners, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Anita Federici. Academically, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I'm in Canada. I'm in Ontario, Canada, so north of Toronto, for those of you that are sort of maybe in this area. I run a clinic up here that specializes in the treatment of eating disorders and emotion and suicide and trauma. I do a lot of work on an international level training hospitals and organizations and working with clinicians to really think about how we think about and how we conceptualize and treat what I would argue are some of the most misunderstood people. So in a nutshell, I do a mix of things related to clinical work and research and teaching.
Amazing. Fantastic. Well, yeah, it's such an honor to have you on the podcast, honestly, because I think you're going to bring so much knowledge and experience. So I'm very excited to chat to you. And I guess to get us started, you do a lot of work in DBT. Would you mind explaining in your words what that is and how that's relevant for eating disorders?
Sure. DBT, yeah, it is quite a mouthful, right? It stands for dialectical behavior therapy. And it's a really unique treatment that was developed, geez, back in the 1980s by Marsha Linehan. And it was a treatment that she developed based on her own lived experience, right? She was somebody that was diagnosed with schizophrenia and she had lots of suicidal behavior and was hospitalized. And she felt deeply misunderstood by the field. She went on to develop a treatment for people that struggle just like she did. And so she really created a model that integrates cognitive and behavioral elements. You know, we have to look at what do people tell themselves? What's the narrative you have about yourself? What are the behaviors that we do to cope with things that are really difficult to deal with, right? She added this whole other piece, and that's what dialectics is. It was this emphasis on being able to simultaneously accept a person and communicate and appreciate how they make sense exactly as they are right in this moment. And really, truly, genuinely accept and be with someone while finding ways to help them build a life that they felt was worth recovering into, right? And so when you start to do traditional cognitive behavioral treatments, they're kind of relentlessly change-oriented, if you've ever done them, yeah. Right? Especially in eating disorders, right? You're going to come in, you're going to start eating, we're going to weigh you, we're going to move in this direction, we're going to do exposure to feared foods. And there's validity to that, but my gosh, that's very difficult to do when you have other things going on, like emotional pain and dysregulation, suicide, self-injury, trauma, co-occurring autism. How are you supposed to approach a sort of relentlessly change-based intervention? It's not possible for many people, right? And this is what I found years ago working in the high levels of care and eating disorders. There were so many people that just were unable to stay in those treatments, these medically modeled cognitive and behavioral interventions, which drew me to dialectical behavior therapy. And here you had someone like Marsha Linehan who took a group of women who were considered treatment resistant, borderline personality disorder, right? Can't help them. And she actually showed the whole world that actually you can. They're not resistant. They're not manipulative. They actually just require a different type of treatment. And that was the birth of my own academic and clinical work around, my gosh, could we use this for people with eating disorders? To explain DBT, it takes a lot of time, but it is a treatment that blends acceptance-based practices, mindfulness-based approaches, spiritual Zen Buddhism with elements of change, because you kind of got to change something if you want that life that you're longing for or missing. That was a really long answer.
That's totally fine. No, and as you said, it needs the explanation. I think it's interesting because so much of what I've seen in the past in terms of eating disorder treatment, as you kind of said, is about like exposure to things and facing your fears and things like that. But that's all well and good. But what I found when I did CBT anyway was it was very kind of pigeonholed, I guess, in a sense of like you face this one thing and okay, you did that, but you don't really explore the emotion behind that, or you don't explore it as a wider concept. And then I think the DBT, I did some DBT work as well. And for me, the biggest part for me that stood out was that acceptance piece of kind of being able to be almost okay with the things that are going on, but then build coping mechanisms to manage them as well.
It's helpful to hear your experience in these different modalities. And I think that by the time people usually get into a DBT program, I'm talking about individuals living with eating disorders, by the time they actually find their way to DBT, because it usually isn't a frontline offering, right? So it's, you might get a skills group, but I wouldn't call that DBT. To really be in DBT is to be involved with a philosophical approach in which everything is looked at from a dialectical lens, and it, meaning that multiple things are true at the same time. You may want to die and you may want to recover. Both things are true. You may want to not binge and purge and want to keep hang on to this eating disorder because it helps you cope. Like, I'm not interested in which one is right or wrong in DBT. I'm interested in the fact that both are true. So how do we move forward? Right? Whereas, you know, other models are less likely to do things like that. And so I do find by the time people get to DBT, there's so much internalized hopelessness, invalidation, even from the system, again, misunderstanding, that the early phases of DBT, I always say it's the you make sense conversations that I like to have with people, which kind of sounds basic. Like, wouldn't that happen in every therapy? But people will say, well, why hasn't anyone ever explained it like this to me before? You know, like people make sense. Even though some of their behaviors might be ruining their lives, the behaviors still, when you understand the biology of an eating disorder and the biology of emotion dysregulation, and then you add in neurodiversity and sociocultural elements, shoot, you know. I love getting to that place like, oh my gosh, you make so much sense. What do we want to do about this?
Yeah. I love that aspect of, I guess, maybe the two truths being almost contradictory to each other, but also being able to exist at the same time. What you were saying there about, like, yeah, I want to recover, but I also want to keep these behaviors because they're my only coping mechanisms. Like, yeah, two truths can exist at the same time, but if you can't have that acceptance to those two truths, how can you recover? Because you have to accept the fact that actually you do want to have those behaviors because they're all you've known to get by, but then actually being able to work through them and build other mechanisms that are more supportive. I mean, that's been my experience of recovery.
I think you have to, you know, people feel so exquisitely broken and feel, you know, especially in this age now where there's, you know, criteria for late stage or severe and enduring or terminality, right? You know, I say, well, often those are the same people who have never responded to standard treatments because they were never designed for them in the first place, right? So I kind of go, are they really, you know, untreatable? Or is it that we actually have never offered them alternatives early on that probably would have been a much better fit for them? Not everybody. Look, I am not anti-CBT or FBT. Those are incredibly helpful treatments for a great number of people. And sometimes you just have to figure out how to get some food into somebody so that they don't die. Like, sometimes that's the reality. And I think there's lots of different ways to be with people and to understand that they are surviving and trying to regulate. And that all of these behaviors, the eating disorder, self-harm, suicide, alcohol use, whatever it is, yelling and screaming at someone even, all of those are actually attempts by this individual, I think, to kind of survive. And the minute that you start to understand that that's what somebody's doing, one, they make sense, because we all want to survive, really. And two, there's so many more ways of helping people that go beyond cognitive interventions and strict behavioral ones.
I think something that I wanted to pick up on because I think it's very much a conversation that's being had at the moment, is things like untreatable. But there's a lot of talk in the media at the moment about terminal anorexia, untreatable, you know, even severe and long-standing, or severe and enduring, whichever way that you want to put it. All of this terminology that's coming out, I don't personally think it's that helpful. And I don't think it's necessarily accurate. And I wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't find the dialogue around this helpful. I don't feel like it's advancing the field. I think it's created quite a firestorm in our field. The reason that I have gotten involved in these discussions around terminology, because when I first saw it proposed, the thing that hit me the most, like I said to you, was that the very criteria upon which proposals for end-of-life care, right? You had to be a certain age and you had to have tried treatments that didn't work and you had to be able to consent and these sorts of things. These were also the particular people that I work with day in and day out in my med DBT treatment. Like they're the same people. And I'm like, wait a minute. How is this group saying that these folks are terminal? And I'm sitting here going, oh my gosh, you totally make sense. And we build lives worth living all the time. That's how I started. Mm-hmm. Well, it didn't make sense to me. What makes sense to me about this conversation is the incredible suffering that people living with longstanding, whether it's anorexia or not, I don't think it's limited to anorexia. I think that's the other piece. But I think that anyone living with a longstanding eating disorder is experiencing a type of suffering that most people probably can't understand. The physical pain, the sense of hopelessness and despair, the exhaustion of the individual and their family. I mean, we can't ignore that. However, I can't separate the fact that those people get there because of the structure of the systems in which we treat them. And people say to me, oh, you're naive, Anita. Like, there's always going to be people that don't respond. I'm a bit relentless that way. I say, well, that's our job then. Our job as researchers and clinicians is to continue to get into the labs, study new models, and find something, just like Marsha Linehan did. So before Marsha Linehan, if you were especially a woman and had borderline personality disorder, you were labeled effectively terminal. You're never going to get better. They didn't use terminal back in the day, but they said, you are treatment resistant. You will not get better. There's nothing that can be done. So I say, if I accept that there are some people that cannot be helped, why should I ever continue to explore other options? Because to me, that's the ultimate blaming of the patient. You're just not motivated enough. You're just, right? So for me, it's problematic ethically. I'm not saying that there aren't cases for which people may decide to access an end-of-life care. I don't know everybody's situation. I'm not trying to, right? But I am worried that the dialogue that I hear in the papers that I see written mean that the majority of people, especially the ones that I treat, are all eligible. And I say, but that's not true. In fact, Hannah, I have a handful of patients right now here in Ontario, in Canada, who are under 30, who have been labeled terminal, who end up coming to me and who literally tell me every week they do not want to die. They just can't tolerate the systems of care that currently exist. But my gosh, if there was a way to help them. So I say, well, how is that terminal? I think there's just too many ethical loopholes for us to empirically say what is and isn't terminality. So I'm concerned. That's where I come from.
Yeah. I think from my perspective as somebody that's been through recovery, the thing that I really struggle with is, and you mentioned the term hopelessness, as you know, when you're in the depth of an eating disorder and things feel very out of, you know, it's interesting, you know, talking about things like control, because people will often say that, you know, one of the reasons someone could develop an eating disorder is because they want to feel a sense of control. And, you know, actually then when you're in it, you're completely out of control and you just have no, because it feels like there's no other way to cope with life. And one big thing that I'm so grateful for my therapist when I was in recovery was holding that hope for me. You know, that I saw as a big kind of part of our work together and her role was every week coming back when I'm sat there saying there's no way out of this. And I do not want to get better and I will not get better. She continued to stay hopeful and she came back every week. And so I think that in my opinion, it's the role of the clinician that you're working with to hold that beacon of hope. And I think, you know, I have the same worry as you in that the more and more we talk about this terminal eating disorder, it then makes me think, you know, one, if anybody's had any doubts about the fact that, you know, eating disorders could potentially be terminal, is that then making them think, okay, well, you know, people are using that term now, so that's fine. But then also right. New clinicians coming through, you know, is that going to shift their perspective because they've not had the experience of having so, like, worked with so many clients that have been at the depths of despair and have come out of that?
These are excellent points, right? Right. It begs the question, what happens if your clinician, your practitioner doesn't believe that you might get better? You know, what would have happened to you or so many others? So there's a couple of things here. One, you know, one of the other reasons I really like DBT is that there are a set of assumptions. So if you're going to be a DBT provider, you agree to a set of assumptions, right? And those are things like, I assume and believe that everybody in every moment is doing the best they can. I don't believe in manipulation, splitting. I don't believe people like the sick role. Like there's this, right? So I believe everyone's doing the best they can to cope. And I believe everybody wants to get better. And better to me is not medical. I don't define recovery ahead of time in DBT for people. That's a co-constructed journey, if you will, in this model. What I do say is I've never met anybody who didn't want to feel safer, more grounded, if given the chance. You know, people say this to me all the time. If I knew I could get that, I'd run for it. I'd go right toward it. The problem is by the time people get to me, let's say, or people like me, there's so much hopelessness that they don't believe it anymore. So things like terminality or suicide become a way of coping with that fear that no one knows how to help me. My God, that's such a despairing place to be. And so there's a number of these assumptions that go on in DBT that actually help guide what we do and how we think of people that I think are really important. You're also, your point about how publications around terminality shape the field. One, we know that most practitioners don't have any training in eating disorders. The ones that do have generally less than 5 hours. I'm talking about general physicians. So you're right. The fear is that they will, as is happening here in Ontario, in Canada, I have physicians who have seen the New York Times article on terminality and have a person in their care who is, in their words, difficult to treat. And so they figure they've tried everything. So this must be one of these terminal people, right? The other thing, Hannah, that I wish to highlight is that I spend a lot of time working with clinicians around the world, with teams, with clinicians, talking about and helping them with what they would say are some of their most challenging cases. The thing that I see time and time again are clinicians with good hearts, well-meaning, they really want to make a difference. They don't know how to handle the multi-diagnostic part. They don't know what to do with the emotion dysregulation, the suicide, the self-harm, the communications of despair. And so I think there's a real lack of support and training, even for clinicians in the eating disorder field, to know how to sit with that and move with it without either feeling hopeless themselves, or a lot of them just get scared. So they see suicide or self-harm and they go, I can't do this, or you need a higher level of care. My patients don't get better in higher levels of care. They get safer. They might get medically stable, but they don't recover in higher levels of care. In fact, they're probably more invalidated. Ah, there's so many pieces to this, aren't there?
There really is. And I think that's such an important thing to note, is that it's a very complex conversation, and there are so many different pieces. And I think as more and more research is coming out, we're seeing more and more kind of comorbidities, or the discussion about how different things that can co-occur with an eating disorder. And you know, I've spoken about this several times in the podcast before, but for me, being diagnosed with ADHD and autism, I was like, oh, well, now it makes sense. Now it all makes sense as to why I've been trying to use my body as a way to fit into society and things like that.
Yeah.
you know, that's just one example. But I think, you know, every single person I've spoken to that has struggled with an eating disorder, as their recovery's gone on, either they have been pre-diagnosed with something and then the eating disorder's developed, or they've realised something whilst they've been in recovery from their eating disorder. And I think you're so right in that. I think one of the biggest pieces we're missing is that clinicians don't know how to almost hold that space for, you know, I'm not saying that when I say complexity, I don't mean you're saying like, oh, you're too complex or something like that.
No, me either.
At the end of the day, it is a complex situation in terms of trying to understand how all of the different pieces fit together. And I think for a lot of people that are that are labeled untreatable or terminal or things like that, it's maybe just that the situation of how everything is fitting together for them is more complex, but that doesn't mean that as an individual they're too complex to treat.
I completely agree with that. The language and the way that you use it and the way that you are describing the journey. And you know, it's so interesting because, you know, one of the things, part of acceptance, radical acceptance, is not just acceptance of a person, but it's also kind of accepting, like, of course, this is where we are as a field. Like, kind of like, how could it be otherwise? I don't like where we are. It's sort of like, but of course it is, because if I go back 30 years ago, right, this is before social media. This is, so people are not talking like we do now. Okay, so you're pretty insular. The people who were showing up with eating disorders were primarily people with anorexia, you know, in the hospitals. That's what was the birth of how do we treat eating disorders. So in the 70s and 80s, I remember my master's thesis supervisor in Toronto would talk about this. He'd say, we'd get this one person who would show up in Emerge who had anorexia, and everybody was kind of puzzled, right? They didn't really understand. So it's not like people with binge eating disorder, and we didn't even know what ARFID was then, you know, or even bulimia. You had physicians and researchers that were looking at people with anorexia with very limited knowledge of anything about it at a time when the way that you treated mental health was cognitive and behavioral. Like that's what how you treated anxiety disorders. So you have this illness that requires medical oversight, right? Because people are getting very sick and dying. So you have this medical model that swoops in and says, well, our job is to keep people alive. So we'll just feed them and who cares? And everything's just the eating disorder, right? But that was the state of medicine in the 70s and 80s, right? And then you have the state of psychotherapies, you know, Aaron Beck and right? When we said, well, if you had a phobia, we would expose you to the thing you were afraid of. So why wouldn't we do that with eating disorders? That's how it evolved. And the beautiful thing, as much as I don't like social media, the beautiful thing about it is that everybody's talking now, right? So now you have people like me and you connecting across the globe going, that's not my experience.
Yeah.
And it has created an earthquake in the field. And I am so glad I'm here to see it, to be honest with you, because without people talking and evaluating, we wouldn't be as far along as we are, right? So sometimes we have to kind of accept it is what it is for reasons in order to be able to change them, right? Yeah.
No, I think you're totally right. I think it's an interesting time in the fact it's an interesting time in general. But as individuals, we have access to so much more information than we ever did about different things, you know, about eating disorders, about mental health challenges, literally about anything. And in one sense, that's fantastic because we have more access to it. But in the other sense, and, you know, this is my biggest gripe with social media, is that anyone can share anything. And so, you know, there's fantastic individuals like yourself doing research, you know, really digging into things and having these conversations to, you know, reduce the stigma, build awareness, everything like that. But equally, there's also the flip of the coin, and you've got people that aren't qualified sharing things as well. So I think while social media can be fantastic in terms of sharing that knowledge and information, It's a dangerous place as well. And I think that that's where I find it difficult with things, you know, like with the assisted dying bill that's going through in the UK at the moment. And I know that you're doing some work with that as well.
You know what? This is a great example of how dialectics as a philosophy, as a way of understanding human suffering and how people move through change, metaphysics is actually, it's well before Marshall Linehan. It was a philosophy on how does the world change? Why does change happen on the planet with human beings? And it's because there are opposing views that kind of collide, right? That then create sort of the new normal or the new next thing. And so you're actually highlighting, you know, that, yeah, people have very different opinions. This is why the publication of a paper on terminality was such a firestorm in the field, because, you know, a large number of us said, oh my gosh, this is terrifying. And then there's a smaller but very passionate group of people who feel like it's absolutely relevant and appropriate. And that's where we find ourselves in this tension where, so I try to look at what is valid about the other's perspective? What is this person trying to say? And can this other person look at what's valid about my perspective? Like, to me, that is how we can, I think, move forward. So when I look at people who continue to push the assisted dying bill, I'm trying not to. Dialectics teaches me that there are always truths that I don't understand or experience. I have not lived like some of the folks that will message me and say, I am 40 years old and I'm in incredible pain and I've been through 17 treatments and I'm tired of this life. I don't want this. I've never had that experience. There is validity to someone saying, I can't do like this anymore. And there's also validity to the fact that most people can't afford to get to DBT or can't access it. So they, you know, people will say to me, that's great, Anita, if I could access it, but I live in this part of the world and I can't get it or I can't afford that treatment. So what am I supposed to do? And I go, I don't know yet. And there's validity to that perspective. Is dying the option? I don't know. I'm willing to have that conversation. My fear right now with what I see is that the way that it is being proposed and the criteria upon which it is defined is way too lax, meaning that, well, Gaudiani, who wrote the paper and just wrote another piece around this just this week, argues that this is an incredibly small number of people. That is not what I'm seeing on the ground, which is that, like, that may be her intention, but the harm that this is causing, that people who are 25 years old, who have co-occurring autism and ARFID, who've never actually had treatment for that, are being labeled terminal. And I say, well, that's a problem. When the majority of people that I work with qualify.
Yeah.
That's what I'm afraid of the most right now.
And I think that's a brilliant perspective. And that's what I appreciated so much when I did the podcast with Chelsea about the assisted dying bill, was she came at it from a very kind of level-headed perspective. And it wasn't a, oh my God, how can you possibly be okay? No. You know, it was very much kind of seeing it from both perspectives. And I think that's how we have to be with these sort of things. Because like you've said, somebody has struggled for, you know, an extraordinarily long period of time. You can't say that it doesn't make sense that they say, I would rather die than recover because of the pain that they're in. However, I think the point that you make about the fact that the treatment that will support them has never actually been provided, or maybe it's not accessible to them. I think that's the issue that we have, is that we need to be making that more accessible. We need to be finding out what sorts of treatment can help those people, rather than almost as clinicians, not as individuals that are struggling, but as clinicians almost taking the easy route of, we've tried everything and there's nothing left. Can we actually say that we've tried everything?
Well, and it's an interesting, again, what has been tried, you know, what we see too, is that a lot of what people claim is evidence-based care or treatment, when you actually go in and study that, most of the programs are not evidence-based CBT even, or FBT. And you say, well, what is it that somebody's getting that we define as quality? So my colleague and I, Sarah Robb, we just submitted, took us a year. So we put a call out to people around the world to give us their thoughts on the proposed criteria for terminal anorexia. We just submitted our manuscript to a journal and we're waiting on their review of that. The findings, though, so we had over 300 people from around the world, caregivers, professionals, and mostly people with lived experience, provide their qualitative data on the proposed criteria. What was so loud and clear was that people were absolutely not in support of this movement. People agreed with dignity and autonomy and respect, But the entire proposal of terminology and the four criteria that have been published were met with, so I would say, scathing criticism that we've hopefully will have that article published soon and you'll be able to read that, right? So again, if you're going to propose something like terminology, the other criticism is that there's no empirical data to support that defines terminal. And in fact, most people, you know, maybe you know this yourself, most people can have longstanding periods of illness and then actually get better in their 40s or 50s and say to us, my gosh, I'm so glad I didn't die, right? So, you know, I think that when I look at the empirical data, people are not okay with this movement.
Yes, right? Just for people that are listening, and also I am not aware myself, you said the criteria that's been proposed. Can you remember off the top of your head what that is? And then also in terms of your research, the thoughts that people had about that.
So in a nutshell, the four proposed criteria, one was that you had to have a diagnosis of anorexia. So I'm just noticing your reaction to that. That's right. So again, 300 plus people, there were a number of themes around that. One, that it was inappropriate to just talk about anorexia, that this is again prioritizing anorexia over other illnesses. They didn't agree that anorexia was necessary as a criterion. People felt like it meant that people with what I don't like, but it's called atypical anorexia, right? So does that mean people with atypical anorexia who have all the same symptoms but not at low weight, quote unquote low weight? It's definitely low weight for them. So there was a lot of criticism about the fact that you had to have a diagnosis of anorexia and what that meant about pitting anorexia against other eating disorders and so on and so forth. So people did not agree with that. The second one was that you had to be 30 years of age or older. People were quite angry about that. Felt one of our themes was that it was ageist. People felt that it was a sense of giving up on people who are still very young. Criticisms about, again, access to care. A lot of people don't even access care until their late 20s or even 30. So, or what if you start, what if your eating disorder onset is at premenopausal and you're, you know, 35 or 40 years old? So I'm automatically, you know what I mean? Like the notion of 30 also speaks nothing of severity or duration of illness, right? So there's all these pieces that people felt were not appropriate. Another one, the third one, was that you had to have accessed quality treatment, you know? And so people, this was such a powerful, we're going to write a whole other paper because there's so much data on what people said about treatment in the field. It was everything that you and I know, but just written in such compelling language by people. People said there's no such thing as quality eating disorder treatment. People questioned quality for whom, when. People felt that treatments are narrow, rigid, traumatic, and many people said, I've never been able to access treatment other than hospital care in an emergency room. Like, is that quality treatment? So there were, you know, and the last one was consent, that you had to be able to be kind of sound mind to say, I'm aware of what's going on. And people again felt very strongly that when somebody is, as Gaudiani said, in a hunger strike, right? She's talking about a group of people who are severely malnourished, but also saying that they have complete cognitive capacity. And so people are saying, cited things like, oh, when I was in the throes of my eating disorder, I thought I knew what I was saying. But after, I was like, whoa, you know, not so much. We also, you know, how do you ignore that there's significant imaging research that demonstrates that under substantive malnourishment, the prefrontal cortex, where things like logic and decision-making and judgment reside, are severely impaired. In fact, there was one study that showed that people with anorexia, their brain scans looked almost equivalent to people with end-stage Alzheimer's disease. So I say, well, hang on a second. How do you determine consent and capacity when there's evidence that the brain is affected? Now, again, I'm not saying that I have the answers. I think this is so complicated. What I am saying is that a large group of people around the world do not agree with the movement and the criteria that were set forth in this 2022 paper.
And so based on that paper, can you now be diagnosed with terminal anorexia? Like, is it something that's enforced, or was it like a proposal of terminology and criteria?
It's not a recognized diagnosis, like it's, you know, in the DSM, right? It is a proposal for an end stage type of eating disorder that continues to be pushed forward. And intended or not, people are diagnosing patients. I've seen it firsthand. I have medical reports that cite this, where they refer patients to palliative care because they're just not responding. But when you look at what, like, I'm thinking about this one person that I work with who cries in session because she desperately wants to live. Okay. Who has had significant trauma in eating disorder programs. Who has, I think, been incredibly misunderstood for decades at this point, who has been recently diagnosed with autism, right? But all autism, trauma, ARFID, it's not even anorexia, it's ARFID, but all of her medical reports and say borderline / manipulative, and they refuse to update the that demonstrates that she actually doesn't have borderline personality disorder. She has autism. She has ARFID. She has lots of sensory issues, and they refuse. And it's a perpetuation of harm. So she's somebody that's hugely vulnerable. And I think that's what Chelsea found too in her paper, was that people who were accessing MAID or who had accessed MAID were more likely to have co-occurring diagnoses like borderline personality disorder, like autism, for which they had never been conceptualized or treated. And look, the last thing I'll say on this is, you know, I grew up, one of the reasons that I think that people always say, why are you in this field? How did you get here? And I say, oh gosh, I don't know. That's a million answers. But I grew up around a lot of severe psychiatric illness just in my extended family and in my family. And I didn't understand it then. I was just, you know, 6 years old or 8 years old. But I saw parts of my family being treated in ways that I thought were completely terrifying, like locked away, shuffling down hallways that stank like urine, abused. I didn't understand it when I was young, but I've always been interested in helping those that are most abandoned, whether that's an eating disorder or schizophrenia or borderline personality disorder. And then you had that deinstitutionalization movement anyway here in North America in the 1970s, where we were like, oh, let's just let them out of the hospitals. It's too much. They'll be better in the community. And that was a terrible, terrible decision. They were abandoned. And I can't help but feel there's a parallel here. Mm-hmm. That this is another group of people that are, quote unquote, difficult to understand, difficult to treat, whose needs exceed what is available. And this is another way of deinstitutionalizing them effectively, of terminating them in the name of ethics and in the name of care. And I don't agree with that.
No, I think you make a really good point there in terms of maybe drawing those parallels. And I think I always find it such a difficult kind of thing, because fundamentally, you know, of all the clinicians I've ever met, nobody is trying to cause harm. Nobody's trying, well, no. The ones I've met, you know, they've come into this industry and this work because they want to help. Yes. And they want to help people to recover. And I don't know whether it's the same way you are, but I think that unfortunately within our healthcare system in the UK, they're just so underfunded and so under-resourced that people they're going out of their mind. They don't have the capacity, the time, the resources to be able to provide the care that people need. And so I think that, you know, when people turn up to an eating disorder service, and maybe it's, you know, it's not been an eating disorder that's been around for a while, and they don't have different comorbidities and things like that, that they can help them, they can provide them with treatment, and then somebody can get better. And then those cases that maybe have been, you know, somebody's been struggling with an eating disorder for longer, or there's different comorbidities there, they're more complex. That's, I think, when the difficulty comes in, because there's not the resources and there's not the time that you can give to somebody. And for me, that's one of the fundamental things that needs to change, is we need to be putting more effort, more money, more support behind these clinicians so that they can do what they're intending to do. Because, you know, I don't think I've spoken to clinicians about palliative care on the podcast before. And the David Coyle, who I had on the podcast, specifically said, you know, that my job is to be a clinician that saves people. The last thing I want in the world is for a patient to die.
Yeah.
But with the situation that he was in, that is what then ended up happening. And the patient chose, when all options were considered, to have palliative care. And I think it's just so difficult and tricky. But, you know, that's one situation. And, you know, we spoke about that event and that's fine. But I think the difficulty I have is almost the normalization. Mm-hmm. And not in David's case in the slightest, but, you know,
yes,
the clinicians, almost the normalization of this terminology being used, the kind of okayness with it. You know, I'm not okay with anybody being labelled terminal or untreatable, right? Or what was the, you used another word that I often hear as well, that's gone out of my memory.
But, treatment resistant or?
Yeah. and it's just, you know, at the end of the day, living with an eating disorder day in, day out, you know, I'm not going to swear. Well, I'll swear. Whatever. It fucking sucks. It's awful. It's absolutely horrific. And
it is.
But it feels like the only way to cope. So it's.
And there's truth in that, because I, you know, I would say to you, it probably is the only way to cope right now, given who you are at this moment, the way your brain works, and the way that, you know, even the new data on, you know, the findings of anorexia being related to metabolic abnormalities. I mean, that, you know, we're not even integrating what that means yet into treatments, right? So of course, this is the only way that makes sense right now. And actually, it's kind of brilliant in a way, because it kind of works. It's probably
kept
going.
Yeah,
it's, you wouldn't do it otherwise.
No, for me, the chaos of ADHD and the kind of rigidity that the autism desires, finding that balance in life is impossible. So to have something to mute both of those and to find, God, this is something I'm good at, this is something I can achieve, and now everybody's praising me about it. Why would you not?
Why wouldn't you? Like, that's the acceptance piece, right? To deeply go, but of course you're going to want to, and you're not crazy or manipulative for wanting to do that. Mm-hmm. Right? It's part of a biological and then socioculturally influenced illness, set of illnesses, depending on what a person has, right? I think so much of that is lost. But I also think that, you know, we also know that things like restricting eating, especially at least for people with anorexia, the genetics research is just getting published right now, looking at cross eating disorder differences. So I can't speak to that quite yet, but we know that for people with anorexia, restricting eating actually soothes an unsettled biology. It's not just a matter of, you know, weight or control or mastery. It may have those offshoots, but it really is a deeply metabolically psychiatric metabolic illness, you know? And so that has implications for how we feed people. This has implications for how we think about weight. It's massive. That's a whole other conversation. But there's so much that we're learning that is missed in mainstream eating disorder approaches. And so I'm not okay with labeling that group of people who are not responding to treatments that were never designed for them, and then going, oh, well, they're severe and enduring. What's severe and enduring to me is the field, right? It's not the patient. Hannah, it's so good to talk to you. You know what? I love that you welcome in such really intense conversations. You know, it takes a lot of courage to enter these conversations. A lot of people want to avoid them. So thank you for doing what you do, because you do it really well.
Thank you. That means a lot. I think for me, it's so important that we're having these conversations. And I understand that there's a lot of people, you know, that will shy away from them, or, you know, it can be sometimes maybe, you know, people have differing opinions and therefore the conversations can't happen in a constructive way. But my hope, you know, the more that we have these difficult conversations is that, yes, they're always going to be difficult, but, you know, by actually having them, we can then, you know, actually initiate change rather than these things just lingering and then not building on them. And, you know, the amount of people the palliative care episode that I mentioned with David, you know, that was a difficult episode for both of us to record. But we've had so many clinicians come back and say, thank you so much for having that having that conversation, because not only did it open my understanding about it, but also, you know, as a clinician, I've lost a patient, but I've never wanted to talk about it because of the shame. So, you know, for me, these conversations, they're not just for people out there that are living with an eating disorder and feel completely lost in the system. It's for clinicians. So it's opening up that conversation that, you know, if you're hearing about terminal anorexia or you know treatment resistant patients or what have you, if you don't agree with that, that's not how the status quo has to be, and you can challenge that.
You know, and I think, again, you know, you model such, you know, natural dialectical thinking, which is, you know, if we don't accept what is, and what is that there are different opinions about this, there are big emotions, and we need to kind of go, okay, what makes sense? Just like when you said to me, you know, this is how I cope. And I go, well, yeah, it makes sense, right? Why would it be otherwise? You have to you can't ignore the conversations or not enter them and hope that they're going to kind of, I don't know, disappear or something. They won't. And so I think we all need to be brave enough to have dialectical conversations where we acknowledge that there's multiple truths, and I believe that we'll find a way forward. I mean, that's how we work in DBT, right? It's okay to not know what the path forward is. It's knowing that there is one, right? That's it. Yeah. And so thank you so much. I have a lot of respect for what you're doing and the way you do it. So keep going.
Well, honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And I, you know, I really appreciate it when people also want to have these conversations with me, because it helps me learn. It helps me, my kind of thoughts and feelings about it grow as well. And just to finish us off, if people are interested in finding more about the work that you do or having a conversation with you about any of this, is there anywhere they can go to have that, to reach
probably
out to you?
I mean, I've got a website. I can send you that information. You know, I'm on Instagram, Dr. Anita Federici, and I try to post, you know, talks that I'm doing or, you know, research, things that I find, you know, sort of interesting, fascinating. You can find me there. I love to connect with people. I love to hear from people. So yeah, I'm out there.
Yeah. Well, honestly, it's been such a pleasure to speak to you. I'm so glad we finally got to do it.
I know, me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Thank you very, very much.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.